the most righteous king we've ever had was King Yoshiyahu. He's the only king that the text says that worshiped God with all his heart and all his soul. B'chol levavcha, b'chol nafshecha, b'chol modecha. And one of the most important things that he did is that he resurrected Passover. He resurrected Pesach. This is how the book of Divrei Hayamim describes the Pesach that he created. V'yarem Yoshiyahu livnei kol livnei ha'am tzon kvasim bnei izim ha'kol lepsachim lechol haninza limispar 30,000 uvakar v'30,000 eile merechush ha'melech. I won't go into detail, but the details are saying something. That it was a massive celebration in Jerusalem of collective Pesach. Now this king that resurrected the Pesach, Chag Yetziat Mitzrayim, was the king that went to war with Mitzrayim. And I would like to ask, is it a coincidence that the king that resurrected Exodus, escaping Egypt, was the king that took Yehuda, that took the Hebrews to war with Egypt? And I don't think it's a coincidence. But I want to try to enjoy this tension a little bit more. Because as we know, and as we've established in our last lecture, there was a big price to pay for going to war with Egypt. And the price was, we went to war with Egypt, not only did Yoshiyahu die, but the Egyptians then punished Yehuda for going to war. And they appointed an Egyptian governor. It was actually one of the sons of Yoshiyahu. They changed his name. They call him Yehoyakim, and now he's the Egyptian representative. Now, Yehuda is lost its independence. Now, it's under the control of Egypt. So let's think about this just a little bit more. We're back in Egypt. We're back under Egyptian control. We're not back in Egypt because they returned geographically to Egypt. We're back in Egypt because Egypt came to Yehuda. Egypt came to us. So I find it kind of weird that the king that resurrected the celebration of escaping Egypt is the king that brought us back to Egyptian sovereignty. Now let's ask it again. Is it a coincidence that the king that resurrected the notion that we are liberated from Egypt is the king that because of him we lost our liberty to Egypt? So I don't think this is a coincidence. And we have to think, okay, so what's the connection here? One way to think about it is that after creating a Pesach, Passover, now there's a very strong anti-Egyptian national fever. We beat Egypt back then. We could beat Egypt. We could defeat Egypt again. That's one way, like a nationalistic reading. But I think the better reading is a religious reading. It's not a mistake because of ultranationalism. It's a mistake because of false religious awareness. Because what happens to you when you practice Passover, when you practice Pesach, when you celebrate Exodus? You get reminded of those great miracles that happened all those years ago. Now, I want to just remind ourselves of those miracles. There's many miracles, but probably the most dramatic miracle that captures what the story could do to its listeners is Kriyat Yamsuf. It's a moment where they tear apart the Red Sea. Exodus chapter 14, verse 10. Ufaro ekriv. Pharaoh was getting close. Where is he getting close to? The people of Israel escaped Egypt. They're in front of the water, the Red Sea. And then for some reason, the Egyptians changed their minds. And the Egyptians that let the people go decide to chase those people. They change their mind. And now they're getting close to the people of Israel. The people of Israel, in front of them is the water. They look back and they see Egypt. So now they're terrified. and they start yelling and praying to God. ויאמרו אל משה, המבלי אין קברים במצרים לקחתנו למות במדבר. Are there no other graves or graveyards in Egypt that you took us to? It's like they use sense of humor when they're complaining. Yes. That you took us to die in the desert is a very cynical remark. Ma zot asita lanu lotzien mitzrayim. Why did you take us out of Egypt? Every time things are hard and tough, they'll regret they left Egypt and they'll want to return to Egypt. Here's the first moment. Halozeh davar asher dibarnu lecha bemitzrayim. We told you when we were in Egypt. Lemor chadal mimenu, leave us alone. V'na'avda et Mitzrayim, and we'll be slaves of Egypt. Ki tov lanu avod et Mitzrayim imotenu b'midbar. Now they are quoting themselves. Meaning, you know how people in the middle of an argument, they quote what they said in the last argument? Well, that is exactly what they're doing to Moshe. Back in Egypt, you told them, leave us alone, don't take us out. And now we're repeating that. Why didn't you leave us alone? Why didn't you take us out? I can understand them. I think we could all understand them. They're in despair. They're in a situation where there's no hope. They're in an impossible situation. The water is in front of them, the Egyptians are in back of them, and it seems like there's no way out. And of course, the moral of the story is, there's always a way out. Even when it seems like it's an impossible situation, it's still a possible, the impossible could still happen. And so what does Moshe say to them? V'ema Moshe la'am, al tirau, hityatzvu ure'u et yeshuat Adonai. Don't be afraid. Just stand. And observe and watch. Et asher yaseh lachem hayom, ki kasher ra'itim et Mitzrayim hayom, lo tosifu nirot od le'olam. Just watch the drama. You're observers of the drama. Not participating of the drama. Not leading the drama. Just observing. Just watching. Something big is going to happen and you have to be passive and watch. Adonai lachem lachem. God will fight for you and instead of you. And you'll just watch and enjoy the party. Something big is going to happen. So I have a question. If this is the memory of Pesach, that these great things happen, where God is active and you are passive, God controls history and all you need to do is to believe that even when it seems like there are no options. There's still an option. There's miracles. The impossible is always possible. That's the message of Pesach. I don't think it's a coincidence that after you learn that great message of Pesach, that the impossible is possible and God can do anything, then they go to war with Egypt. It seems like they expect that the miracles that happened in the past will happen again. They go to war with Egypt because when you're guided by theology, when you do politics, by this version of theology, that you expect God, because you're devoted to God, to be in your pocket, to be in your side. So you expect, yes, the Pesach we just celebrated is not only our past, maybe it's our future. And you go to war with Egypt. Because, yes, from a secular, skeptic point of view, you're weak, Egypt is powerful. But from a religious point of view, God is with you and God is more powerful than Egypt. That's the real strategic equation of history. And let's trust that strategic equation. You go to war with Egypt and you lose because reality kicks in. And now you're back in Egypt. Now this could be an argument for not celebrating Pesach. This could be an argument for how Pesach and celebrating Pesach and remembering the great memories of the great miracles could create irrational politics. It create an expectation that the miracles will come back, and that expectation could create very wrong decisions. So let's not celebrate Pesach. Shabbat Shalom. What I just presented is Yoshiyahu, Josiah's understanding of religion and of Yetziat Mitzrayim and of this narrative. What I'd like to argue is that's not the only way we can understand Exodus. That's not the only model, the only way that the memory of those great miracles could shape a national awareness. There is a different way that those memories could shape a national awareness. And I want to now to present an alternative to Josiah. This is the alternative presented by Moshe in his final speech. How does Moshe understand Exodus, and what is Exodus supposed to do to our national awareness? It's supposed to make us arrogant, expect that miracles are supposed to happen, and therefore we could attack anyone and do anything that we want. Is that what Exodus is supposed to create? Or maybe it could create a different kind of an awareness, and this is, I think, how Moshe understands the impact of Exodus. So again, we're back to the basic work of Dvarim, the basic work of Deuteronomy as the fifth book of the Torah, but also the first interpretation of the Torah. And as an interpretation of the Torah, I want to follow the interpretation of Moshe to some of the commandments. And the first commandment I want to listen, the first mitzvah I want to listen to the way Moshe interprets is Eved Ivri. Where does the mitzvah of a Hebrew slave, where is it? Where do we find it for the first time?
In Exodus.
In Parashat Mishpatim, and it's presented in a way that this is the first mitzvah that they hear when Moses comes down from the mountain. It's the first mitzvah after he comes down from the mountain, after the Ten Commandments. So we have in Parashat Yitro the Ten Commandments. Then in Parashat Mishpatim, a whole new set of mitzvahs, and the first mitzvah is Eved Ivri. What's the mitzvah? If you have a slave, the slave could work for you for 7 years. Actually, for 6 years. But what happens in the seventh year? You have to liberate him. You have to let him go. He can't stay and be your slave. So that's the first mitzvah that's after the Ten Commandments. Just to remind people that forgot, the Ten Commandments weren't supposed to be the Ten Commandments. They were supposed to be the 613 Commandments. God says the Ten Commandments, and the people ask God to stop. They couldn't take it anymore. They were terrified. And God stops the collective revelation of speaking directly to the people, and he starts the revelation where he speaks to Moshe, and Moshe speaks to the people. So that idea that it's an indirect revelation was the will of the people. There was the Ten Commandments of direct revelation. And then, Eved Ivri is the first mitzvah of indirect revelation through Moshe. Now I want to ask a question. Is there a connection between the first commandment and the first mitzvah? Let's examine this. What is the first commandment? The first commandment is, Anochi Adonai Elohecha, I am the Lord your God. Asher rotzeiticha me'eretz Yitzrayim, mi'bet avadim. The first commandment is an introduction. God is saying, I am the Lord your God, and I am the person that liberated you from slavery, from Egypt. That's that introduction. Asking the people to notice that God is the being or the person that's in charge of their liberation from slavery, recognizing that is the first commandment. What is the first mitzvah? You need to liberate your slaves. You can't hold on to them. You can't control them. You have to let them free. I want to ask a question. Is there a connection between the first commandment and the first mitzvah? I feel like there is. Maybe what's happening here is the first mitzvah is God liberated slaves. The first mitzvah is you need to liberate your slaves. Maybe the first mitzvah is a fulfillment of the first commandment. God is a liberator. God liberated you. You have to liberate others. Now, this is a question I always ask myself when I read Torah. Is this connection only in my mind? Or is it really there in the text? Is the fact the first commandment is God as a liberator and the first mitzvah asking us to be liberators, is that just a coincidence? or something's going on here. We're asked to do to others what God did to us. Is it only in my mind or is it really in the text? It's hard to know, it's hard to tell because it doesn't say. But what I want to argue is that this interpretation is exactly the way Moshe interpreted this text. I want to see now how Moshe interpreted Eved Ivri. And to do that, I want to see how he repeats Eved Ivri. How does he repeat this mitzvah? And for that, we're going to go to Deuteronomy chapter 15, verse 12. Ki imacher lecha achicha ha'ivri o ha'ivriya. By the way, he's adding something. What did he add here? He's adding the female slave. Also, she needs to be liberated. It wasn't clear in Exodus. There is an egalitarian motif in Deuteronomy. We find it here also. The seventh year, you should let him free, let him go. Don't let him free empty-handed. You have to give him fruits, you have to give him what he needs in order to acclimatize to his new civilian life. And then it says, this whole thing was for this verse, for verse 15. Vezacharta, this is the reason why you have to let him free. Vezacharta ki eved hayita be'eretz Yitzrayim, you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Va'ifdecha Adonai Elohecha, and God liberated you. Al ken anochi mitzvcha et hadavar hazeh hayom, and that is why I am commanding that commandment today. The connection that I thought might have only been in my mind, I think is the exact connection that Moshe did in his mind. God liberated you, therefore you need to liberate others. When we let our slaves go, we're not only obeying God, we are also imitating God. With that idea and that concept in mind, I want to see how Moshe reinterprets another commandment, Shabbat. And for that, we have to go to Deuteronomy chapter 5. Now, this is something we've done in one of our last lectures. But I want to take from this move something else, another motif and a different motif. In Deuteronomy 5, when he repeats the Shabbat and therefore interprets the Shabbat, he says that the reason we need to observe Shabbat is Leman yanuach avdecha v'amatcha kamocha. The purpose of Shabbat is not to rest. It's to let your slaves rest. Yes, it's different than Exodus. In Exodus, and that's the part we say in Kiddush, it's about resting. In Deuteronomy, it's not about resting, it's about not controlling. That's the mitzvah in Deuteronomy. In the interpretation of Shabbat in Deuteronomy, Shabbat is about letting go. It's about not controlling. It's collapse of social hierarchy one day a week. It's the democratization of the privilege called rest. We rest. Your slave might not work like you work. There's a hierarchy of work, but there's not a hierarchy in rest. He rests just like you rest. That's one day that you can't boss him around. That's one day that you can't control him. By the way, you can't control your slaves. You can't control animals. You can't control anything. Shabbat is not a day of no work. That's Exodus. It's a day of no control. It's a day of letting go. And then, in verse 15, it says, why is Shabbat a day of not controlling your slaves? Letting your slaves free one day a week. It says, why? And it says, V'zacharta, ki eved hayita be'ereth Yitzrayim. And you shall remember that you used to be a slave in Egypt. V'yotziyacha Adonai Elohecha misham b'yad chazaka u'vizron etuya. And God liberated you. He let you free in that big drama. Al ken tzivcha Adonai Elohecha la'asot et yom ha'Shabbat. God liberated you. You have to liberate your slaves every Shabbat. Again, emitatio dei. In Exodus, emitatio dei, imitating God, was God rests on Shabbat, you rest on Shabbat. The emitatio dei of Deuteronomy is God liberated slaves. You have to not control your slaves in Shabbat. What does it mean to be like God? What does it mean to try to be like God? Well, Nietzsche and others understand that there is a human fantasy to be in complete control. Some people call that control. Rav Kook calls that fantasy God envy. God is the ultimate power, ultimate control, and you want to be like God is your to fulfill your fantasy of control. What Moshe says, being like God is not controlling. Being like God is not controlling. It's letting go. It's giving up power. It's letting your slaves go. It's letting the people that work for you free. We'd like to try to put this together. What is Exodus for Yoshiyahu, and what is Exodus for Moshe? For Yoshiyahu, Exodus creates an expectation that miracles happen to us, might happen again. Exodus is an expectation. The great things that happened in the past could happen again in the future. It's something that has to happen to me. For Moshe, Exodus is not about, it's not supposed to create an expectation for something great that's supposed to happen to us. Exodus is about who we need to become. Exodus is not about something that needs to happen to us. It's not about miracles. It's about responsibility. You were liberated, you need to be a liberator. What happens, you know, the Torah deals many times with memory of suffering. And part of the Torah is how do you transform memory of suffering into sensitivity. You were an immigrant, become sensitive towards immigrants. You were a slave, become sensitive towards slaves. It's not easy to make that transformation. We know from modern psychology that people that suffer in the past could become cruel in the future. We know that people that were battered might become batterers when they're adults. We know that pain in the past doesn't have to lead to sensitivity. But the Torah guides you to transform memory of pain in the past to a character filled with sensitivity. The Torah is about how you deal with pain, but the Torah is also how do you deal not with bad memories, but with good memories. Not with pain, but with miracles that happened in the past. And also great things that happened to you could be bad for you. You could become an entitled person. When adults and grown-ups were great to you and nice to you, you might think that that's what you expect the world to behave towards you when you're an adult. That's the Yoshiyahu model. Great miracles happened to us in the past. Well, they're going to happen again. We're entitled, and that's what we expect. Moshe understands that we need to transform great memories, good memories, into responsibility. If the Torah is about transforming memory of pain into sensitivity, it's about transforming memory of great things into responsibility. I was liberated, I need to become a liberator. Exodus is not about expectation for something that needs to happen to us. It's about who you need to become. Now you need to become a liberator. What is Exodus 2? We learned the Yoshiyahu model and the Moshe model. Our past defines who we are in the present. But we can influence the way the past defines who we are in the present. That's what the last speech of Moshe is trying to do. I would like to start putting some thoughts together towards my last remarks. Moshe in the end didn't enter the land of Israel. Why didn't Moshe enter the land of Israel? Why didn't he? Because at that moment, that sin we've all learned and not always understand, I'm not sure I understand that sin. God told him to speak to the rock. And he didn't speak. He hit the rock. In some way, His sin was the sin of not talking, not speaking, not using language. Interestingly enough, 40 years beforehand, when God wanted to hire him for the job, to redeem Israel, to take Israel out of Egypt, to take him into Eretz Canaan, into the land of Israel, Moshe didn't want the job, and five times God offers it to him, and in different ways, Moshe has the same excuse. What does he say? I'm not a man of words. He says he's aral sfatayim. He says he's kvad peh. He says, lo ish dvarim anochi. I don't know how to talk. Isn't it interesting that for the same reason that Moshe didn't want the job, for that reason, he lost the job. He didn't want this mission because he doesn't talk. He lost the mission because he didn't talk. But the irony only begins here. It doesn't end here because, okay, so he's not entering Israel because he didn't talk. And then he climbs a mountain and he doesn't stop talking. He delivers his entire speech. Sefer Dvarim. Ele ha-dvarim asher diber Moshe. Not bad for a person that is lo ish dvarim anochi. The man that is not a man of words, the entire book that he has in the Bible is the book of dvarim, words. But then you read this speech. And in this speech he says, listen, when you cross the Jordan Valley, here's one commandment. You go to this place that is between Har Grizim and Har Eival. And take this speech and carve it into a rock. Oh, and every 7 years, another mitzvah, get together and read this speech out loud. Oh, and a third mitzvah, when you appoint a king, the king has to write down this speech himself and read it his entire life. It seems like part of the speech, Moshe is asking them to take this speech into the land of Israel. Moshe wants his last words to be his eternal words. I think, what is Moshe trying to do? I think he is trying to sneak into Israel. He is trying to enter Israel. He's saying, I'm not entering Israel. My words will enter Israel. So because he didn't speak, he's not entering Israel, but everything that he spoke, everything that he said, those words, they need to enter Israel. And what are those words? In the last 8 lectures, we try to study those words, their meaning, and using other biblical books to understand in a deeper way the ideas that are in Dvarim, that are in his words. Moshe understood something big. That entering Israel is more than changing their location, it's changing their status. The movement into the Holy Land is also a movement into power. It's about a powerless people becoming powerful. That's what Deuteronomy is about. That's what the whole narrative is about. Powerless people becoming powerful. A nation of slaves. Conquering Canaan. Building a successful monarchy. A powerless people becoming powerful. I think it's very interesting that that is the biblical narrative. And I want to notice that if anyone would try to describe the history of Jewish people in the 20th century in one line, I think they would say, it's a story about powerless people becoming powerful. The shocking resemblance between the grand biblical narrative and modern Jewish history means that the Bible could be alive today. Because the last speech of Moshe is at that moment right before they become powerful. And Moshe understands that when they become powerful, well, power corrupts. And absolute power corrupts absolutely, and power could change them. And he's afraid of that. You might have hubris and arrogance and a sense of entitlement and a sense, false sense of immunity. Power could change you. Power corrupt you. Could corrupt you. But here's what Moshe doesn't do. He doesn't say power is dangerous, so don't become powerful. That's not what he's saying. He's saying power is dangerous, become powerful. Just use it the right way. Ever since Plato, there's something we know about power. Power could change you, but we need power. And here's a paradox of power. We need power to change the world. But once we have power, sometimes it's our world our internal world that changes. And here's the biggest question. How can we have power that will enable us to change the world without that power changing our own world? I think that is what Deuteronomy is about, or that's at least what it's also about. How does a nation become powerful and still sensitive? Powerful without hubris. Powerful enough to change the world without their world changing. And this was the journey we tried to do the last 8 lectures, trying to create a religion that's not about power, not about control. Politics that's not about control. Politics that doesn't lead to tyranny. Those are the great challenges to the 2 revolutions of Moshe. The people that become powerful, how do they use power? How does their life not become a life that is obsessed with control? I'm not sure that the Hebrews at that time implemented the 2 revolutions of Moses. That vision and that challenge is still alive today. Thank you.